No. Kind of looks like a bath mat.
Next.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 296 for the week of March 30th, 2020. I am TV ready front door graffiti David T. Cole, and I'm here with overnight pants Sarah D. Bunting.
Et voilà.
Seam ripper Tara Ariano.
You call that a seam?
And object of Naomi Campbell's unending scorn, Heather Cox.
Next.
Welcome to Extra Hot Grape. Joining us this week is our dear friend, one half of Go Fug Yourself. It's Heather Cox. Hello Heather.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Sorry, I stole your quip thunder with my choice of clips at the start there.
Oh, it's all good. There's no, you can't hear that too many times.
That's true.
It's really true. We are here, as you, if you already watched it, you know from the clip at the top of the episode, we're here to talk about making the cut. Here is the premise summary. So this is the new fashion show.
Can I just do it?
Sure.
Project Runway, but slightly different.
Well, I mean, I've listed all the ways it's slightly different. So this is Heidi Klum and Tim Gunn. They ditched Bravo. Now they're on Amazon. So Heidi is the host slash member of a judging panel. Tim Gunn is the mentor. It's a fashion design competition. Sounds familiar? Yes. Here are the differences. Number one, it's on Amazon. The first two episodes take place in Paris. And judging by the season super tease, future episodes move the action to other international fashion capitals. All of the designer contestants are already somewhat established in their profession because, as we're told several times over the course of the first two episodes, this is not a sewing competition. The designers get to hand off their partially completed work with detailed instructions to seamstresses at the end of each workday and get finished pieces back the next morning. At least in the first two episodes, they're challenged to create two looks per show, which are a more ambitious runway look and an accessible interpretation of it that can be sold to consumers, which the winner's looks will be after each episode on Amazon, of course, where else? And more than one designer might get cut in each episode. When select designers are brought forward to be critiqued, either because they're in the top or in the bottom, they get the chance to talk the judges out of axing them. Two episodes will drop every Friday until the winner is named and awarded the prize of $1 million. Now, indulge me for a second. There's an episode of Friends from the Arrow and Monica's Dating Pete, the software billionaire played by Jon Favreau, where her friends think that he's about to propose and Rachel gets all excited and says they could have a theme wedding. And the theme could be, look how much money we have. And I feel that was also Amazon's theme here. Heather, what was your reaction to what we are seeing on the screen?
That was 100% like, let's just do Project Runway, but more expensive.
Yeah.
Like, and every way that they could come up with to do it, including paying other people to do the sewing.
Yeah.
Was, and trying to outspend on the judging panel and all that stuff. Like, it was, it's, I mean, I find that otherwise the show is so disposable. Like, it's, Project Runway has moved on without them and is arguably better without them. And I don't really think this show has anything new to say. Like, even the whole idea that they're looking for a global fashion brand, or not just looking for a new designer, they're looking for a global fashion brand, is meaningless word salad. Like, they have no more control over someone becoming a global fashion brand than, like, Top Model does over any of those girls actually getting modeling work and becoming successful at it. So, like, it's just, it is literally just people throwing money in the air because they can.
Sarah, do you agree?
I do. There are things that I like about the judging panel itself. I think that Nicole Richie has some interesting things to say.
Mm-hmm.
Is a sentence that I just said into a microphone and allowed to be recorded. I enjoyed her verbal skirmishes with Naomi Campbell in the first couple of episodes. But a lot of this is just, like, I wasn't upset or bored during it, but then it's like one of those books that you just put it down and then, like, 2 weeks later, you put it down face down and the edges of the paperback have curled up and you're like, like, we're done here. I just have no desire to check back in on it. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a good through line from episode to episode because of the way it's structured. Like, there's really like almost exclusive focus on whoever's going to be that hero slash fuck up of the episode. Mm-hmm. and you're not dealing with any of the other designers, so like storylines aren't balanced well. I would be interested to hear what Heather has to say about that particular aspect of the build. But and just the Heidi and Tim go on friend dates. Who cares?
Oh my God. Agonizing.
Yeah. Like fast forwarded through it.
It's not a popular opinion, but I, toward the end of Prodded Runway, I really sort of felt like Tim Gunn was very disposable. Like he seems like a wonderful human being. And I don't mean that as a person, he is not useful, but I don't think he adds much to the show.
No, Sarah and I have talked about that.
Oh, okay.
We,
yeah.
We agree.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like that he was starting to piss us off, actually, and that both he and Heidi kind of seemed to feel like they were Project Runway, and that's especially not a good look for Tim.
No, and I think that the Heidi and Tim segments like exposed the worst of that attitude. That they were painful to watch. They were like, and Kevin was drifting in and out of the room while I was watching them. And he actually like did a double take on some of those with a look of exquisite horror on his face. I was like, I know this is, I'm so embarrassed for them right now.
Yeah.
But I do. Yeah. I think Tim just sits there. And even when he's called upon to offer some insight, you know, you imagine what Christian Siriano would have said in episode 2, when they ask about, I already can't remember her name, but the goofy woman who gets eliminated in episode
Martha.
2, who is Martha. Thank you. I wrote down all their names and I still can't remember it. And they sort of asked him for the inside story, and he gave them this really oblique, carefully crafted, like gentle answer. And I'm like, you really need to say that she just completely lost her shit and couldn't handle it and walked out. And like, this is where you say that.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do it. So all he does is stand there and tell everyone, like, it's stunning. It's exquisite. And that's all it is. And none of that has changed. And so you're sort of like, well, we've already seen Christian Siriano doing this better than he did it. So why are we watching him do it again?
Yeah, the sewing aspect of it, I mean, they say it multiple times. I said in my rundown at the top that, you know, this is not a sewing competition, which fine, but shouldn't this be a sewing competition? Because, like, you know, I just wonder what they said to convince Martha to do it, to make her think, oh, I can walk into this without any technical knowledge at all and it'll be fine. There'll be a seamstress there. I can tell her what I want versus what actually happens, which is, if you haven't watched the show, that you have to like cut your own patterns. You have to like basically put them in a bag with extremely detailed instructions that describe what it is that you want.
Which, just do it yourself then.
Right.
Like as a sewer, it's like, well, if you've done all that, but like if you bothered cutting the pattern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're trying to sell it as, oh, we're the show that's true to the designer's ethos and everyday experience as professional designer, blah, 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 right? But what they're doing actually then is just setting up some limitations on another way to do it. So it's not like your seamstress is in the room with you at the table and you explain it as you would do if you run a business. Like you think they're just putting things in a tech bag and hoping for the best overnight? Like, no.
I watched Phantom Thread. I know how this works.
That reminds me to get mushrooms.
Well, and what if your seamstress sucks?
And you're, yeah, exactly. It's a total, you're asking them to skip a step. Like I don't think Christian Siriano or, you know, Michael Kors or whoever sits there sewing everything and cutting everything himself, but you know they did at some point.
Yes.
You know they came through someone's ranks knowing those basic skills. So I don't understand if you're looking for just like a cute person who sort of has an aesthetic and can like twinkle in public for a little while, fine, but that is that really a global fashion brand? I don't know.
Right. Like, this is why when she did have her meltdown, and like on the second day, what happens is she throws out one of her designs and then she's too far behind and can't get ahead because she does not have the technical knowledge to do what needs to be done in the time that's left. And so she's ready to walk out. And at that point, I was like, she should go. Like, she has no business being here. Tim Gunn should be like, you're right. You're in over your head.
Reality shows in general should let people go easier and more often.
Yes!
Like, it is just like, I don't know why people buy into, okay, here comes the dramatic non-walk-off again.
Uh-huh.
Like, when they actually do like, all right, fuck you, see you later. That's great. You know, like everybody got what they deserved. You got a better show out of it.
Yep.
The producers got their little moment and that person's fucked off and is not gumming the works anymore. Like that should be
totally
the way things work.
When we did Tough Enough, I think the first season of Tough Enough, maybe we did like three actual eliminations and everybody else. We had people quitting left and right in like the middle of episodes.
Yeah.
And it was great because you were sort of like, well, I don't know how we're going to structure this now, but it's like, that's just what happened. They literally were like, this is miserable. I got to go.
Heather, you should tell the children who don't know what Tough Enough was because then they will understand. understand why that happened.
Oh my God, right. Gather around, children. Let me tell you a tale of when the WWE was called the WWF. It was a wrestling-based reality show in the early aughts that was on MTV, and it was literally, it was hosted by Al Snow and a rotating cabal of other wrestlers, and they taught a bunch of unwitting, physically strong people the art of wrestling, and people were allegedly eliminated in every episode, but because wrestling is actually, it's fictitious in some senses, or it's made up in some senses, but the actual physical pain part of it is not. People were quitting all the time because or getting hurt and having to leave. But it was our little half hour gem on MTV, and it was kind of fun, and I miss it. It's from harken from the days when we didn't actually, things weren't scripted ahead of time, and they just sort of shot what happened.
It sounds like we found the missing element in making the cut, which is physical violence.
Right.
I completely agree. Yeah it's a, and you know what? If anyone's going to do it, it's Naomi Campbell.
True.
Am I remembering right that you recapped that show and then moved into it? Or was it like you're recapping something else and they found you?
I recapped Making the Band, which shared an executive producer with Tough Enough. Yeah.
That's right.
And so that's how I got that job. Fun times. I also wanted to agree with Sarah that I think I'm shocked. I actually really liked Nicole Richie when she was on Great News, the sitcom.
Yes.
But I did not imagine that, like, when they called out the judging panel and it's like Corinne Rotfeld and Naomi Campbell and like even Joseph Altuzarra, and then it's like, and Nicole Richie, it was kind of a wah wah sort of moment in terms of your actual fame level within the fashion world. Mm-hmm. But she's pretty good. She, I mean, I don't think Corinne Rotfeld has much to offer at all in terms of what they've shown in the judging. And Nicole Richie actually has some stuff to say, and she's not afraid to defend her opinions.
She's sharp. And there were a lot of times where she fulfilled what I felt like Heidi did in the early going of Runway, which is she will say, I would wear that or I would not wear that, and it actually matters because she's a tastemaker. Like, she mm-hmm. she does take risks with fashion, and it makes a difference if she would say, I would wear that or not. Like, in the first episode with Martha's looks, that one dress she made was hideous, and but when it walked, I was like, that dress is for Nicole Richie at the start of Nicole Richie's career versus...
Mm-hmm. To paint a picture, everybody else is dealing with relatively classy, and this one person, Martha's doing bubblegum.
Yeah, I mean, the print that she picked, like, was specifically, every time I saw it, it was like, it reminded me of a specific bedspread that my aunt had in the 1970s, but I liked it, and then she did, like, a sort of bandeau top and a wide leg pant as her runway look, and it worked for me. I thought it looked really cool, and I could picture Nicole Richie in it, but anyway... yeah, I agree. Nicole Richie, I think, is a great judge. The rest, I think, are fine.
Naomi Campbell is just petty. I know she's going to be like petty and mean. Like, I don't know if you guys watched The Face when she was the judge on that supermodel show that she helped. I mean, I kind of loved that show, and I thought she was exquisite. She was also just like terribly sharp on that. And I mean that in every sense of the word. Like, she was mean, and she also, like, she knew how to cut a bitch.
There were a few times I thought she was going to, like, strike Coco Rowe, that I was like, all right, this is funny up to a point, but don't make me worry that there's going to be like intra-judge violence, because, you know, safe one distance. Slap with your non-dominant hand and Coco Rowe is dead. So
nutty.
But yeah, that show is sort of interesting. Like, when you have a judge who really, like, I don't think she's even going for like the sound bite the way Michael Kors did sort of at the end, where it was really strained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that way, I think she's just like used to being able to say whatever. And like, that's part of her brand, is to just be rude, basically.
Yes.
So, but that's kind of refreshing.
It's amazing. And the fact that she showed up for that second episode judging in the giant shoulder pads and like whatever the dress was made of, it was like the longs, almost looked like long stripy tassels or whatever. Like, she just was, she took up as much space as she possibly could. And I was like, this is so on brand for you. And it makes you look like, it makes you count. Like, I don't know, like, you've got she has presence. Obviously she's Naomi Campbell, but like, she uses it. I mean, I think the one thing I think they do that is, there's a couple of things I think are kind of weird. I agree with Tara that I think they don't spend enough time with the other contestants. And I know that they probably don't want the show to be 2 hours long, but I think the judging format is so messy. Like, everyone's just sort of assembled in a clump in the workroom. Mm-hmm. It looks like an informal, like a rap meeting after a live show. Like, okay, let's talk about what worked and what didn't. But like, no, you don't actually get, none of them are getting meaningful feedback. And so we don't understand anything about what they think of anything and where anyone stands. It's just, it's a mess.
It looked like when you are in an office environment and somebody has their birthday, but nobody really knows each other that well. And you just sort of clump around and like, well, guys, are we really going to sing happy birthday? Because,
Yeah. But the other problem is that on runway, like they're there with their models and their looks. And sometimes the judges will get up and go and look at them closely and be like, see, here's what you fucked up. Like, I mean, I'd never missed that more than in that second episode that like I wanted Martha to get read worse for essentially making two Marge Simpson dresses, one of which was held together with safety pins. Like, it's a couture challenge. But even if it wasn't, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing?
Why are you here? Why are you
here? And I think she didn't even, the fact that she didn't even really try to defend herself or like, she was done. She was out.
No, she didn't.
And it made for whip. And this whole like two people could go home, but the way they structure judging is such a jumble that there's no tension or drama about like who is or isn't. And the whole, and has any of the judges changed their mind? No. Like who cares? Just like tell, like, I feel like the whole thing has no dramatic sensibilities whatsoever. It's really frustrating. And my other beef is this concept of that one of the dresses has to be quote unquote accessible or one of the outfits. And their definition of what is accessible is so broad to me that it made like some of the stuff that comes down the runway, like the Esther's dress that won in the first week was like a basic black whatever. And I was like, sure, that accessible. Like, does accessible mean inexpensive to produce? Does it mean something lots of people would want to wear? Because some of those accessible outfits were insane.
Yeah.
And like nobody would wear those. So I think they're trying to be too cute, but they don't actually have a relatable definition of what that is. So as a person watching it, even somebody who looks at a lot of red carpet fashion for life, just sort of looking at that going, what is accessible about this? And why do you think the average Amazon customer wants to buy that? Is there strings hanging off?
Well, and you can't. Because there was one look that I was like, let me just see if maybe Esther hooked a sister up with some pockets. She did not. But it was already sold out in every size.
Wow.
It's not, it's like literally inaccessible.
How many do we, like, I wonder if they made 10. Oops, it's a sellout.
Well, they all sold out right away, according to the, I was curious. So just as the show was starting, I went to the Amazon page for the winning accessible garments. Esther's has 2 out of 5 stars rating, and they're all just either why is this dress in polyester or the only sizes you have now after 2 seconds online or small.
Yeah.
And the same for the white, slightly athletic one from season 2. Yeah, yep. Juwan did. And,
did they say how much they were selling for? I did think Esther's looked incredibly inexpensive. Like hers was just, it seemed so basic that I was like, okay, is that what they're going for with this whole accessible thing? But then some of the other outfits that they thought was so wearable, even Jiwon's was gynecological. Like they would have had so to have made that longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I was like, is that a tunic?
Right.
Because no.
Yeah. I mean, with leggings, it would be cute. Do you have an answer?
$50 for the white one from 2. Oh. First one is probably comparable.
Yeah. I mean, there hasn't been any, not that I noticed, but there wasn't any talk about budgets for what they were shopping for either. So that, I wonder if that was what informed it too, if it was like your accessible look can't go over a certain amount in terms of the materials you use. I mean, again, they could use more transparency in this. All of it is not clear to the viewer.
It seems like they've spent all their time explaining all these other twists that they've put in and then not enough time laying out the parameters of stuff that make the viewer actually able to understand what they're getting at. I don't know.
Here's the most unfair review.
Okay.
Not available. WTF. The show just aired. How can there be no sizes available? It's so unfair. I would absolutely love this dress, and they said we could purchase it. Very wrong to bait and switch. Shame on you, Heidi and Tim. Jeff Bezos in the corner.
They are losing sleep tonight.
All right. Well, any picks as to, other than Martha, who else is most obviously in over their head in after these first two episodes?
Who can even tell?
Do I remember anyone's names? I mean, I think the Johnny guy they were talking to, where all he makes are these leather jackets don't even look very well cut. And they were like, you got to come up with something else to do with leather. And he was like, well, if I was a global designer, I could totally do that. And they were like, right. Sold, which was the worst defense of his brand ever.
You know what his brand should be called? It should be called Johnny Dangerously, not King Swing or whatever the hell it was.
It seems like it's Esther and G1 are the only ones they regularly like. Mm-hmm. Oh, and there was the older gentleman who made his mother's wedding Sabato. Dress for his mother.
Yeah.
And who's the guy who's the teacher at Parsons? I liked him, but I'd also just rather watch him and Tim sit around drinking brown whiskey and talking what it's like to teach these 20-year-olds who were like, well, I'll just send it out to a seamstress. And they're like, oh, honey, no. So I don't know. This show, I was excited about it. And I just feel like they had a big opportunity and a lot of money to do something way better than this. And I just can't quite care enough to like go back to it. Like, I'm not mad that I watched it, but I don't need to keep watching it.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Agreed.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate 3. I am not a crackpot.
This comes from Emily, who writes, I am not a crackpot. Period TV shows should have period appropriate commercials. Okay, maybe I am a crackpot, but how much better would this be? I've been watching the ITV Miss Marple on Hulu, and every commercial break is so jarring, partially because the breaks seem to happen at totally random points, but mostly because the tone is totally off and the products don't make sense. Would this be absurdly expensive and fairly pointless to most people? Yes, of course. But would it make the viewing experience better? Obviously! I'm not saying that the commercials shouldn't be real, blah blah capitalism. They can be for real things that existed then and still exist now, or just be made in an old-fashioned tone. Either way, they might even win awards. There are awards for advertising, right? But mostly, I just want to watch a clever old lady solve gruesome murders in the 50s without being distracted by modern Geico and Peloton ads. I guess I could just pay for the ad-free Hulu or advocate for no commercials, but we all know neither of those things are going to happen. So, not a crackpot. Special period-appropriate commercials for period TV shows. Thank you for humoring me.
Let me just say this. Paint a picture of why I think this is actually a really good idea.
Yep.
Let's think back to the Mad Men finale, mm-hmm. when Don Draper is going hippie and goes to that retreat and thinks of the I Want to Buy the World a Coke.
Yep.
If they actually found advertisers that had commercials, contemporary commercials to that, and pepper them through that episode,
yeah,
that would have been amazing.
It would have been
and
great.
That was enough of a moment in pop culture that they would have gladly got on board with that. Alka-Seltzer, plop plop, fizz fizz, like these are the commercials that were probably around the same time, mm-hmm. in addition to that one Coke commercial, obviously.
Yep.
Just generally, like, even if you don't have products that existed then, like, why not go the extra mile and build yourself a approximation of something that would have happened then for a product that exists now? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine how, like, having something set in the 40s but still have like the Empire Today jingle, you know, but it's all sort of just like scritchy and scratchy and you know, there's sort of a wartime sisters singing group behind it kind of thing. All that would work, and it would be like, it might actually make people watch the commercials for once or twice. And as an aside, before I pass it off to other people, I just want to say, when we went on safari, we stayed in Nairobi for a day or two beforehand, and the breakfast buffet there featured pancakes, and you could have them with marple syrup, according to the tag that was there.
Aww. Yes.
So sweet.
Anyone else have anything to add?
I mean, I totally agree. I think it would be super fun. I think the idea, you know, people are these days trying to convince people not to skip commercials for obvious reasons, and they do anyway. I think event commercials, that if people are going to skip them, they'll go viral on the internet. Like, that is a thing. That's a thing people have to pay attention to now, is how their brand is present online. And so I think there's a number of smart advertising reasons why you should play along and make your commercials, you know, they don't have to be Super Bowl size events in order to be interesting and buzzworthy. And I just think it would be super smart. And honestly, if you're in advertising, don't you think it would be more fun to do that than to do another 12 ads where Aaron Rodgers has a dumb State Farm agent he hates, but for some reason, a dumb sports agent he hates, but he somehow still doesn't fire? Like, let's do fewer of those and more of creative stuff.
And I think she pegged it to the past, but why not futuristic shows with futuristic commercials too? That would be fun too.
I'm just giving this idea away for free. Future Clio winners, The Peloton ad is now Penny Farthaton.
Cute.
And the instructor is wearing like full waistcoat, bowler hat.
Follow that carrier pigeon between the Peloton instructor and rider. I want you to get commission for that so bad.
Time to go around the dial. Our first stop is Tara Ariano.
Briefly. First, Call the Midwife, return to PBS.
Great.
On Sunday for the premiere of its 9th series, which in American terms is approximately equivalent to a show coming back for its 58th season. But if you were thinking that the gentle rhythms of Call the Midwife were exactly what you needed to give you a respite in this trying time, I am here to warn you. The premiere involves a small, adorable child getting the respiratory ailment diphtheria, triggering everyone in his class being quarantined. So maybe save it and watch it in a little while.
Yeah. Gotta get your dip tat, honey.
That's right. Much more fitting is One Day at a Time. Didn't that get canceled? Yes, it got canceled on Netflix, but it got picked up by Pop TV last year. What's Pop TV? Don't worry about it. They're also simulcasting it on TV Land, both on Tuesday nights. So check your local listings for the time. By the time you hear this, the first two episodes will have aired. I've seen the first three. They are great. Definitely up to the standard of Netflix, although Pop has truncated the theme song, which is a mistake. I'm sure that's for sticking in ads, having more time for commercials. I get it. Again, capitalism, I understand, but it's a pity. It's such a great theme song. Anyway, I was not that worried about the move to Pop TV watering down the show content-wise, because Pop also airs Schitt's Creek, which obviously is not low on queer content, also a feature of One Day at a Time. But in addition to that, the third episode, which I will not spoil, explores sexuality from a different angle and does it in a way that manages to be both sex positive and also acknowledge that the situation in question is uncomfortable and awkward, because that's a real feature of sex that also deserves to be portrayed in a truthful way. Alex, who is the son of the Alvarez family, has always been the most neglected character, possibly because the kid who plays him was the most limited in the cast talent-wise, but it looks it looks like he's coming along. They're giving him more to do this season, which is interesting. And episode two features Robinson Ash III from 90210, Sarah, selling couches.
Buddy.
Yeah. So if you never watched the show because you don't have Netflix but do have basic cable, now you can see what we, mostly me, but also some of our past guests have been on about all of these years. And if you do have Netflix, watched and loved it there and thought the show was over forever, good news, it's back and it's still the same show you remember. So yay for One Day at a Time. And for my plugs, I wrote about why One Day at a Time deserved to be saved by Pop TV. That's at Primetimer, and also at Primetimer, I wrote about Black Monday on Showtime and why the producer's decision to never show female nudity but to show male nudity quite a bit has been really interesting and has let them explore all of the various different ways that penises can signify. So, yes, it's filthy, but it's, it's kind of a thinker. So we'll link to both of those in the show notes. So check that out.
It's Heather's turn. Go, Heather.
Oh, I'm so bad at this one, you guys. I'm always so behind the curve on everything. Last time I was on here, I think I was advocating for a bunch of really sexy CBS network shows, and I'm going to tone down the sex appeal a little bit this time. We started binging Barry on HBO, and I don't know why we slept on this show the first time around, but it's a short, easy binge because they're only half hour episodes. There's only two seasons right now. And I have found that it was perfect for the current mood of the world because it's like real dark in parts, but also extremely funny and sharply observed at times. And so it sort of feeds both the side of you that wants to laugh right now and the side of you that like is horrified when you look out at the state of the world and wonder what's coming.
Yep.
So it's a mood and it's the right mood. And it's also not like a super heavy commitment. The only episode I haven't seen is the pilot. And I'm told that it wasn't maybe necessarily as funny as some of the episodes that came after that. So if you watch the pilot and you think, well, you told me it was funny and it's not, I promise you it gets good. So that would be, if you're looking for something to watch, do that. And then the thing that we've been watching with our kids that we've been streaming that I don't think needs the promotional help, but I'll do it anyway, is Lego Masters, which is the Lego building reality competition that Will Arnett is hosting. And it's very charming. He is extremely sort of hacky with the comedy, but the one thing I find sweet about it is that he genuinely seems to try and invest in each of the pairings when they're having trouble. And he seems to really want to try to whatever means he can to make them comfortable and sort of help them along. And it's sweet to see him make that effort, because some hosts kind of just show up for the paycheck and then leave. So I appreciated that. And if you have kids at home who are bored right now and need things to do, a couple of my friends and I had used this as an excuse to make Lego challenges for our own kids, and they film videos of themselves presenting their builds and pass them around. So it's turned into like a good inspiration for something to do during quarantine. It's super funny. And the border we get, the more elaborate the videos get. I believe we employed a GoPro last time to drive around the neighborhood and then use it as the backdrop for a green screen. So it don't have to be that elaborate. But anyway, it's been super fun. And it's something that, if your kids are bored, you can use the show to inspire them to do their own thing. And like, it's been a good social activity for them to just pass around movies. So that is my around the dial.
Nice.
I love it.
You know, it's a good thing about Barry right now is not only is it just cathartic in that sort of, you know, violent comedic kind of way, but mm-hmm. it's offering very direct solutions to problems that are evident. And God knows we would like some of that right now, wouldn't we?
Yes. It's perfect on many levels. And also, like I've always appreciated Bill Hader as a performer, but there were times when I was watching it when I was like, is Bill Hader hot? I think he might be kind of hot. Like, it was a moment for me I had to come to terms with.
Yeah.
And what are your many, many projects you can plug right now?
What will I plug? I'm going to plug, we have a sequel to our book, The Royal We being me and Jessica, who is my co-writer on Go Fug Yourself. We have a book coming out. It's coming out in July, but you can pre-order it now, called The Heir Affair, Heir being H-E-I-R, and it is a sequel to The Royal We. So we're very excited about that, and we're hoping that books still exist when that happens.
too.
And I'm going to also, I guess I'll plug, my husband works on Legends of Tomorrow. It's a CW TV show. It's crazy. It's time travel. It's semi-superhero-y, but it has a really wacky sense of humor. And if you haven't seen any of it, just pretend season one didn't happen. Start with season two. And they're in, I think, season five right now. And it's good. And they're doing a lot of really fun work. And I'm really proud of what he has added to the show. So I wanted to give that a boost as well.
And I think I just read that because a lot of CW shows are short, they're re-airing the Crisis on Infinite Earths event that was all across all of their superhero shows.
Excellent. Yes. I think, yes, Kevin probably had a hand in various scenes in all of those because they had to do so much cross-scheduling. But yes, the crossover. And I think the crossover was weird because it wasn't actually part of Legends' current season because it aired before they started. But yeah, they're going to be re-airing a lot of that stuff. And I don't know. It's a fun season. They've done a lot of really, they had a great takeoff on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that just aired, which was really quite funny. So I don't know. If you're, again, looking for something funny and a little bit twisted, I'm going to recommend Legends of Tomorrow.
And a new season of Tough Enough coming.
Wouldn't that be great? I mean, I think if we're all in quarantine long enough, it's going to happen inside people's houses.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Top Chef is back with an all-star season. I'm always like skeptical of all-star seasons that I immediately get sucked in. See Survivor, which I was like, they handled this dance situation like shit. I'm never watching this. Oh, Sandra's back. Like, I'm such a sucker for these. Anyway, on Top Chef 17th season, there are a lot of people to root for, like Nini, Voltaggio the Elder. Speaking of not, you know, lady frontal nudity, but Padma's boobs, still amazing. See plenty of those if that's your thing. There's lots of people to root against. I'll get into it. This is a weird one. Like, there are certain shows during, you know, capital A, all of this, that you feel like they're going to be good or escapist or entertaining, and then they don't quite, like, for whatever reason, it's like this uncanny valley of distraction where it just doesn't quite work. Like, they're just weird, or you can't stop looking at everyone like standing too close together, or they seem really irrelevant, or they make you feel the difference between quarantine and the before time, like in a way that is intense and not good, like you like. But for whatever reason, in my opinion, Top Chef is not having that effect. Dan and I, not gross survivor Dan, my husband Dan, are just enjoying the challenges and mostly like looking at the food and occasionally pausing to fantasize about our first lobster roll out of captivity whenever that glorious event may occur. Dan is at home and doesn't know what his job is going to look like a month from now. And one of the contestants is a former client of his who was a throbbing pain in his ass for like 6 months. So if nothing else, seeing her on the show is reminding him that not being able to do real estate is perhaps not the cloud, but the silver lining here. Any hoodle, it is working for us. And if Bravo is smart, they will watch what's cooking up, some kind of Top Chef Last Chance home kitchen spinoff that leans into the quarantine. And then non-gross, non-survivor Dan, my husband, can go on that because it turns out he can make risotto from scratch, we found out. So, and like really well, like not just passively not crunchy. It's good risotto. That is not, in fact, my plug, because you guys can't come over to enjoy it. My plug is that On the Blotter Presents this week, which is available as you're listening to this. I'm talking to my friend Mike Dunn about HBO documentary The Scheme, sort of tangentially about college hoops. So if you're really missing March Madness, check that out. And also a little ficty content for you with Finding Steve McQueen. And if, unlike Dara, you can't get enough Tiger King coverage, I wrote that up for Primetimer, and all of that will be in the show notes.
I don't really have like a full thing to talk about, but I really just wanted to play this one clip I really enjoy from the latest Better Call Saul. So if you haven't listened, spoilers.
Spoilers, ahoy.
This is just a scene between Howard and Jimmy at the end where Howard's sort of prodding of Jimmy to get back into the fold at his law firm kind of comes to a head. And it is a Bob Odenkirk that is very yelly, but not in a particularly comedic way. So it's got an edge to it, which I really enjoyed. But also, I just really enjoyed the verbiage at the end, which I think I will have to isolate and use on the podcast often. So yeah, here's that clip.
Let me tell you something. The job offer, it didn't upset me. It amused me. Big job at the illustrious HHM. Chance to play at the palace. Little old me. You have no idea what's going on. You're a teensy tiny man in a teensy weensy little bubble.
Oh, Jimmy.
Oh, don't you fucking old Jimmy me. You look down on me, you pity me. Walk away. That's right, Howard. You know why I didn't take the job? Because it's too small. I don't care about it. It's nothing to me. It's a bacterium. I travel in worlds you can't even imagine. You can't conceive of what I'm capable of. I'm so far beyond you. I'm like a god in human clothing. Lightning bolts shoot from my fingertips.
I'll be using that in life and on the podcast for a little while.
That's not what I thought you were going to clip when you said you were going to make
the marriage clip.
Yes,
I'm saving that for another time.
Okie dokie. Yeah. Okay. All right.
I will say Better Call Saul, I feel like they are now off the ramp, now on the highway to the why Kim is no longer in the picture.
Yep.
It's making me very anxious.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Same. Yeah.
Ugh. Now, if you haven't been on our feed for whatever reason, and shame on you if you haven't, we are every Friday releasing two extra, extra hot greats, our usual one that we release to our Patreons. Thank you for your support.
Yes.
And a old one that we're releasing to the general public on the regular feed as what we're calling quarantine helper. It's just an old episode about whatever topic we had. I think last week was recasting.
Last week was recasting, yeah.
Which was us recasting Star Trek and Law and Order, Gilligan's Island, Happy Days, yeah. And a whole bunch. That was really fun. This week, so our quarantine helper is ? I haven't decided yet. Mm-hmm. Our real one is For the Times. It is called Help, and it is just a collection of very stupid or relentlessly funny or just like incredibly comforting TV shows that you can watch mm-hmm. right now. And then next week on this very Prime podcast, we welcome back Adam Sternberg to talk about the 25 Quibi shows we have access to at the moment, all in their 5 to 10 minute glory.
Yep. Someone moved heaven and earth and got screeners. That someone was me. There's some crazy shit, you guys.
Yeah. So it's our Game Time come to life. It's an actual thing that wasn't a shtick we were doing.
Nope.
Quibi next week on Extra Hot Green. The backwards music that means this week we are ready for a Nonak submission. Before I play it, I just want to give a little history about how we approached this one, which is when we get submissions, we thank everybody a lot for the submissions. They're always fun to go through. I take them and I put them in the doc so everybody knows when it comes time to pick something, such as when Heather picked our show today, which is Sherlock, season 4, episode 3, the finale, the final problem, that it's available there. Here's all your Nonaks and here's all your canons. For some reason, I stuck this in the canon. And she chose that, and we're all watching it, I'm sure, from our thing. What the fuck? Why is this episode being submitted for the canon? Mm-hmm. And because it's, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, spoilers, but it's a really bad episode of Sherlock.
Great. And,
I want to say what my strategy was going to be if we did not subsequently figure out that this was a Nonak submission, because nobody except me listens to the case before it goes live.
Right.
I was going to pretend for the sake of this that it was Tara's canon submission so I can yell at Tara for even thinking that this was canon worthy. But we don't have to now because it's in fact a Nonak. We now join Erica with her Sherlock Nonak submission. Take it away, Erica.
Sherlock was a brilliantly acted, beautifully shot, occasionally masterfully paced show. And while Series 4 wasn't as good as the 3 that came before it, it's a real head-scratcher that it went out with such a thud. Here are my 9 reasons for why Sherlock, Series 4, Episode 3, The Final Problem, is a real bummer and should be inducted into the Nonak. Damn thing's an hour and a half long, so I'll talk fast. Here goes. Number 1. Mycroft fights a clown, for Christ's sake. Sherlock is pissed enough at Mycroft to do the following. Break into his house, splice footage into his favorite film, which looks terrible, rig doors to lock, slam, or open on cue, unlock the gun in Mycroft's combination walking stick slash sword slash gun, which is the silliest prop I've ever seen, cut the power, damage works of art and rig them to bleed, and hire some of his homeless network to dress up as a ghostly little girl and a clown to scare him into giving Sherlock the information he wants?
Experiment complete. Conclusion, I have a sister.
This was you? All of this was you?
Conclusion 2. My sister, Eurus, apparently, has been incarcerated from an early age in a secure institution controlled by my brother.
Hey, bro.
Why would you do this? This pantomime, why?
Conclusion 3. You are terrified of her.
You have no idea what you're dealing with. None at all.
New information. She's out.
That's not possible.
It's more than possible. She was John's therapist.
Shot me during a session.
Only with a tranquilizer.
You still had 10 minutes to go.
Well, we'll see about a refund.
Right, you two. Wiggins has got your money by the gate. Don't spend it all in one crack, Dan. Oh, I hope we didn't spoil your enjoyment of the movie.
You're just leaving?
Well, we're not staying here. Eurus is coming and someone's disabled all your security. Sleep well.
Dr. Watson, why would he do that to me? That was insane.
Yes, well, someone convinced him that you wouldn't tell the truth unless you were actually wetting yourself.
Someone. Probably me.
Seems like an awful lot of effort for so little in the way of results. Number 2. The boys break into Sharonford for no reason. Sherlock and Mycroft's sister Huris is a magic mega genius who, at the age of 5 or 6, got committed to Sharonford psychiatric facility after she burned their house down. Sharonford is basically, what if Alcatraz, but more, completely impenetrable to breakouts and break-ins, unless, like Sherlock, you are wearing a hat. So again, Sherlock, Mycroft, and John take a helicopter out to sea, hold some fishermen hostage on their own boat. Mycroft dons an elaborate disguise. Sherlock takes the time to write a message in wet sand that says, tell my sister I'm here, all so that they can go into a facility where Mycroft immediately declares that he's in charge now, and therefore all three of them have free passage throughout the place. So why was any of that necessary? Number 3. Huras is basically Kilgrave, or that guy Pusher from the X-Files. by which I mean she can get anyone to do anything she wants if they spend more than 5 minutes with her.
Eurus doesn't just talk to people. She reprograms them. Anyone who spends time with her is automatically compromised.
Sherlock, as a show, has asked me to believe some pretty weird things, but this is the first time it has asked me to believe that someone is actually supernatural. I mean, none of this can actually happen, but this super can't actually happen, right? Number 4. The long, long list of things that showrunners Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat demand that we, the audience, don't think about too much, because they don't feel like explaining it, I guess. Here is a bare sampling. That Sherlock is unable to tell when he is or is not looking at glass. How John and Sherlock both manage to jump out of a closed two-story window and sustain no injury whatsoever in a moment of truly terrible CGI. That Eurus was just waiting around for Sherlock, Mycroft, and John to show up at the same time so she could play her game with them. And by the way, how long has she had those three guys tied up ready to be thrown out the window? And seriously, why couldn't the police solve that crime? Is no one in Scotland Yard familiar with the concept of glasses? To continue, how Eurus manages to get Victor and then John down a 20-foot well without injuring either of them, and why no one searched the well, which is clearly on the property, when a child went missing in the first place. Speaking of the well, John is chained in there, so a rope would only be so much help getting him out. Why Mycroft, who has spoken to his sister many, many times, cannot identify her as the little girl talking to Sherlock on the phone. Which leads me to number 5. The episode lies to us the whole time. The opening scene of the episode is a little girl on an airplane waking up mid-flight and discovering that everyone else on the plane, including the pilots, is fast asleep. As she desperately tries to wake them up, she answers a ringing telephone, and who's on the other end?
Help me, please. I'm on a plane and everyone's asleep. Help me.
Hello. My name's Jim Moriarty.
Welcome. Final problem.
That's actually a pretty good hook, but the problem is that it's a complete fabrication. There's no plane, no Moriarty, and the little girl is just Eurus. We cut back to footage of this fake child over and over again, watching her adventures, hearing alarms going off that we assume Sherlock can hear as well, and it's a total goddamn cheat. Number 6. The Waste of Andrew Scott. Eurus gets a 5-minute visit from Moriarty and learns that the kid she killed is now a dog in Sherlock's mind, and also that Sherlock has friends again. That's it, as far as I can tell. Much is made of this visit, but really, it's kind of a snooze. Most of Scott's screen time is taken up with incredibly irritating messages recorded for Eurus to taunt Sherlock, and also showboating to Queen. Number 7. Mycroft just stops being Mycroft for a while. Mycroft Holmes is a cold, calm, and dispassionate man. He does not flinch at violence or death, except when Moffat and Gatiss, who plays Mycroft, need him to freak out over what a badass Eurus is. Granted, he's being asked to murder a man in cold blood, but retching when the guy kills himself instead? That neither he nor John parses Eurus's command correctly? That he thinks that reverse psychology will work on Sherlock? That's not Mycroft, that's like Lestrade. Number 8. The regular cast women are neglected, tortured, or dead. Mrs. Hudson has one scene with dialogue, and one where she's vacuuming. That's it. Mary shows up in a recording at the end, more on this later, and Molly, poor Molly, will be blown to bits if she doesn't say the words, I love you, and oh man, this is hard.
Molly, this is for a case. It's
a sort of experiment.
Not an experiment, Sherlock.
No, I know you're not an experiment, you're my friend. We're friends, but please, just say those words for me.
Please don't do this. Just don't do it.
It's very important. I can't say why, but I promise you it is.
I can't say that. I can't say that to you.
Of course you can. Why can't you?
You know why.
No, I don't know why.
Of course you do.
Please, just say it. Why?
Because it's true. Because it's true, Sherlock. It's always been true.
If it's true, just say it anyway.
Oh, and by the way, there was no bomb. He put her through all that for nothing. Sherlock, understandably, is completely unhinged when he learns this, but the whole scene is kneecapped at the end of the episode when Molly just blithely runs through their front door, perfectly happy to be there. You know what, Moffat and Gaddis? Take out one of those unnecessary set pieces at the beginning and give me a scene where Sherlock is made to confront this phone call. Don't tell me to believe that Molly is fine with that bonkers conversation and the abruptness of its ending. It's a really good scene, but reducing Molly to Molly Extract, a sad woman who's in love with Sherlock, is infuriating. So the woman who gets the most screen time is more or less insane and is entirely motivated by the fact that her brother didn't pay enough attention to her. Which brings me, finally, to number 9. The end. Heroes killed all those people and set her house on fire essentially because Sherlock didn't play with her and now she thinks she's on a plane?
I'm in the plane. I'm going to crash. And you're going to save me.
Look how brilliant you are. Your mind has created the perfect metaphor. You're high above us all, alone in the sky, and you understand everything except how to land. Now, I'm just an idiot. I'm on the ground. I can bring you home.
No. No, no. It's too late.
No, it's not. It's not too late.
Every time I close my eyes, I'm on the plane. I'm lost. Lost in the sky. And no one can hear me.
Open your eyes. I'm here.
She cries, he embraces her, she goes back to the place where every single staff person is compromised, but it's okay because she's not talking anymore. Wait, what? And then, John finds a recording of his dead wife saying nice things about him and Sherlock. That's it. That's how the series ends. A woman who got fridged taking a bullet for the main character having the foresight to record a message of herself telling said character how great he is. Her husband is almost an afterthought in that she doesn't even use his first name.
When all else fails, there are two men sitting arguing in a scruffy flat. Like they've always been there, and they always will. The best and wisest men I have ever known. My Baker Street boys. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson.
This is not how people do things. It's just Moffat and Gaddis swelling with pride about how great a show they made. And it was a great show. Most of the time. This one, though, real clunker. Show us how good it is, guys. Don't tell us. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. What a great presentation.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. Heather, you chose this. You thought it was a canon, but no matter. We all did. Your thoughts after hearing this no-knack presentation?
Yeah, the presentation was tremendous. I was laughing at the creeping sense of horror I felt when I thought I was going to have to poke holes through someone's canon argument. And when I say poke holes, I mean blow a cannonball through it. I mean, it's a terrible episode. And one of the things that I think one of the worst hallmarks of it is, first of all, they were working toward one of my least favorite things, which is, well, let's just make it that this person's existed all along. And oops, Sherlock has rewritten all his memories himself to erase her. Like, how convenient that is. And nobody really, like, they don't really explain how that happened or why. It's just sort of, you're supposed to accept that he was able to completely reprogram himself. And they also make much out of Eurus's ability to reprogram other people. But they never actually show that happening. So to me, that I watched that and it took me right out of it because I was like, oh, we're listening to her say things. We're seeing her look at people, but we have no idea how she achieved this. And I don't think they do either. And so they just, it was a great thing at the end of there. She said, tell us, or show us, don't tell us. They told us, they didn't show us. And so yeah. it was exhausting. I was like, they went to all that trouble to make this character, but they had no handle on what she was doing, how she was doing it, or why, beyond just like she was lonely and smart.
So right. And like, it's weird to think that Sherlock, which is a real world based detective show, did such a poor job of explaining mesmerism or whatever it is than Watchmen.
Yeah, it was crazy. There's a Welsh author named Jasper Ford who has a series of books called the first one, ironically enough, is called The Eyre Affair, but Eyre as in Jane Eyre. And it's set in an alternate world where the main character Thursday Next ends up being like a literary detective. Like, you can jump in and out of novels and interact with there's like a whole literary world. It's sort of a little bit of fantasy, but it's literary fantasy, which is sort of interesting. And anyway, in the one of the books in that series, an enduring villain is revealed, and her name is Aornis. And Aornis is an earworm, basically, and her talent is crawling into people's heads and making them believe things and do things that aren't real, or altering their psyche. And that book far predates this episode. And I know that might sound a little obscure, but I had to wonder if perhaps some of Jasper Ford's writings were being bitten off heavily by the character of Uros Holmes here.
No, that's a well-known series.
Is it? I'm never sure, because I feel like I only know one other person who read it. But yeah, okay. So, and especially because he's Welsh, and I feel like, you know, they all live on the same island. I could probably read it. But yeah, I sort of looked at that and thought, oh, this is someone who's realized those books have never been developed and may or may have gotten a little more inspiration than is kosher from that.
Yeah. Erica, always nice to hear your voice. I really can't tell you how relieved I am that I could just empty both barrels into this condescending, inconsistent, self-serious piece of shit, instead of having to gently be like, I think there are some issues with the tone. I mean, yeah. There are. It's simultaneously like there's a bombastic level of seriousness with which Uros is treated, but at the same time they're trying to make like silly jokes, like a big red bouncy red alert, like, well, which is it? This is like the end all be all. Like, they make the Silence of the Lambs subtext text.
Yeah,
like, which is it? This this person is a terrifying monster who, like, the Kilgrave comparison is exactly right. Or this is all like a big joke because there's no stakes because it's Sherlock and Watson and we know they'll get out of it. Like, this was just, it was exhausting. Like, the whole interchange between Sherlock and Uros with the violin. Other adjectives from my notes include tiresome, turgid, cruel.
Do you have self-indulgent in there?
Yeah, also self-indulgent. Like, this is, it's not close to as well done or interesting as the show thinks it is. And it's almost like they wanted to sour us. Like, I don't actually give them credit for doing this, but the effect was that I was like, well, I hope this doesn't come back. Because there's like contempt towards us. There's cruelty towards the characters. It was an extremely tiring 90 minutes to revisit. And when we first watched it, my husband and I looked at each other and were like, fuck us. Fuck you. Like, it just really felt like kind of a, you know, simultaneously throwing a parade for itself and also flipping us off. Like, all right, just don't make any more then. Fuck. Yeah. Ugh. I mean, yeah, this is disastrously bad for, and like a real come down for this show. I've just decided for myself to pretend that the fourth series doesn't exist. And I'm happy to no-knack guys that choice, because this is really bad. I will say, Andrew Scott's Freddie Mercury moves are pretty hot, but like, get on with it, bro. What are we doing here?
Yeah, it is funny, Sarah, to think that this is the show being like, it doesn't want to break up with us, so it's being such a shit that it's making us want to break up with it.
Yes. I love that analogy.
Which, you know what? Mission accomplished.
Yep. Number blocked, beesh.
Like, Erica, I mean, calling it a bummer, yes, it is a bummer. Like, yeah. It's bombastic in all of the ways that you said, but also it's just like, oh, what a sad fart of a way to end things. Like, like this is what it's come to, the show that we liked so much. I mean, we just put the series premiere in the can in like last summer, I guess.
And how fresh and innovative and new it felt.
And, yes. And it's all of that has just curdled at this point. Mm-hmm. And like, it just feels so overstuffed and like, I mean, the bad explosion that Erica mentioned, but also like when we're, you know, when he figures out that it wasn't a chicken, it was a baby with the dog, where it's like, that's a MASH reference, where it's like flashing between like grown-up Sherlock and kid Sherlock, and it's like just so much time filling, smashing up the fucking coffin for 10 years, it felt like. It's
oh, God, yeah.
All the blipverts of Moriarty's that are supposed to be enervating, which, like, mission accomplished, but also, like, it's not compelling, it's just annoying.
Yeah.
And I know that's the purpose, but it's also like, why are you making this experience feel this way for me at home?
It also took me right out of it, because I was like, really, you had Moriarty? When did she have Moriarty sit down and film a bunch of just random insert video shots she could use at will? Like right. Okay, give me another read on TikTok a little faster this time.
Let's just say some wild lines.
That would be an excellent after credits thing for this episode. Like,
that's the web series I want.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The more you dig into it, the more you're like, wow, like, everything was a misdirect and nothing meant anything. And mm-hmm. I laughed when she said, how long did Eurus have those three guys bound and gagged and tied to a rope waiting to drop them in front of a window? And that case wasn't even clever. Like, that's the thing. All the times they tried to trumpet their own cleverness, like, that wasn't it. She was like, I was the only one who solved this case. I'm like, why? It wasn't difficult. It was maddening.
It's true. And the idea that it was like the motivation was she just wanted to play. It's like, are you fucking serious? Like, that's what it all comes down to. She was fucking sad. Like, when we get to the point where that they're in the room and she's just, this is what it's all unraveling to, and like, he's solved it, I was like, okay, where's the turn? Like, I was expecting this to be her final, you know, sociopathic mm-hmm. pose to get him one more time. It's like, oh no, this is it? Like, fuck you. And if you're a writer and you actually put, you know, electronic pen to paper and write the line, your mind has created the perfect metaphor. Like, retire from the business and kill yourself, because that is some shitty writing. No one should ever hear it. No actor should ever try to deliver it in that shaking voice as if it has great import. That's fucking terrible. Oh, so
awful.
The one thing that Erica did not mention was, have we considered that all of Eurus's psychoses stem from the fact that her parents named her Eurus?
Yeah.
It doesn't help.
I'm done.
No.
Dave, you can finish us up.
Wow. So many good points in all around from everybody involved so far. I do want to say, just on a totally dumb note, that I thoroughly enjoyed the phrase fridged.
Yeah.
A couple things that nobody's mentioned yet. And the big one is how this sells out Moriarty as a villain. Really enjoyed Andrew Scott's Moriarty. He was really good. And this basically says, well, it wasn't really him. Here was the puppet master behind him, which is such a cop-out. I feel like it's sort of like J.J. Abrams throwing Rian Johnson under the bus. Like, you know, we had this Snoke guy, but nope, he was just a guy in a vat. Here comes the Emperor.
Yeah.
Selling out what came before and diluting what you're trying to present now. And that was sort of one of many bummers in this. And just like the whole convoluted conceits throughout this episode, like the Sherlock versus Mycroft opening, the world's worst sibling escape room setup or something, like, that was terrible. And also, like, how much money did he spend on that? Never mind, like, just how baroque it was. Then the end, which is like Eurus's, it's like the world's worst PowerPoint presentation as a TV show. But kind of puts me like, if this is the finale, which I guess it is probably.
It is for me.
It is. Maybe the solution was this show had the standing and the wherewithal to end the show where Doyle couldn't. Like, they actually took the, what's it called? Reichenbeck Falls? Whatever
it
is.
That's, you know,
it. What was originally Doyle's ending for Sherlock Holmes, him and, you know, Moriarty turfing off and that's it. Why not have that?
Yeah.
You know, it's not a four quadrant ending, but why not do that?
Mm-hmm.
And seeing this as the ending makes me feel that all the much more. Like,
yes.
I wish they took that chance and did that. So, hey, well, just to recap, in case you're playing at home, the nine reasons were Mycroft fights a clown, the boys break into the prison for no reason, Eurus is Kilgrave, showrunners lean on suspension of disbelief to an incredible degree, the episode lies to us from the start.
Yep.
It's a waste of Andrew Scott. Mycroft stops being Mycroft in the episode. The women in the cast are afterthoughts or mistreated. And of course, the terrible ending, which nobody mentioned, but the them running out of the building.
The action pose.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It was so embarrassing.
Jesus.
And I could kind of feel like I could see it in their in the actors' faces. Like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Let's just do this and go get a pint after and try to forget about it. So, bad episode.
Right.
Fantastic presentation. Great comments all around. Let us put this to the official vote. Heather Cox, what say you? Is this a no-nack?
Gosh, guys, I don't know. What do you think is going to happen here? I'm going to vote that it is a no-nack.
Sarah D. Bunting.
The clown was us. Yes, and it is a no-nack.
Tar.
Tick tock, tick tock. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yay.
All right, that means Sherlock, Series 4, Episode 3, The Final Problem. You are very definitely inducted into the Extra Hot Great No Duck.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. Sarah has the winner.
Oh my God. The winner is me because that theme song is joy. In fact, it is all of us and true crime queen Kate McKinnon, who is going to follow up her gig playing Elizabeth Holmes in one limited series about Theranos by playing Carol Baskin of Tiger King in another one. Which might actually get Dara to watch it. Who could say?
No.
And loser?
Several celebrity quarantine busters.
Oh, guys.
First, the most recent Bachelor, Peter Weber, decided it was a good idea to go out on a date.
More like Petrie Weber.
That's right.
Oh.
With one of his cast-off bachelorettes, nice. Some broad named Kelly, in Chicago.
More like Killy.
Yep. Mid-lockdown. Outlander star Sam Huyen. I have no idea how to say his last name, but he was supposed to go to Paley Center, obviously, at the Paley Fest.
More like hewing in the toilet because he's so sick now.
Obviously, Paley Fest got canceled. He decided he was just going to go ahead and go on vacation in Hawaii anyway.
More like in Paley. Oh, wait, that doesn't work.
No, he decided to endanger people on an island state by bringing in whatever was attached to him.
I would have called them Chazwazers.
Exactly. And finally, Evangeline Lilly, who had made a big stink all of last week on Instagram about, like, I'm still taking my kids to gymnastics and we're not going to be afraid, even though my father is immunocompromised. We're not going to let this change our lives. Also, Daniel Day Kim, one of her Lost co-stars, tested positive for COVID. So finally, Maggie Grace, another one of her Lost co-stars, had to get into her comments and be like, can you...
Girl, you dumb.
Basically. And finally, she had to be like, sorry. So, you know, she came around, but she was real dumb for a while first.
Yikes. Well, speaking about being real dumb at first, do you know what time it is? Welcome back, everybody, to Game Time. This is the fifth Game Time of the season. Season scores are Tara leading with 2, Sarah's got 1, Value Guests have 1. Today we are playing Family Ties.
Cha-la-la-la.
Thank you. From John Potsy Potts, who earns himself an extra credit
Potsy.
Topic. He writes, can you name the character based on their relatives? I'm going to read you a series of their relatives through marriage and blood, and you have to name the character we are talking about.
Okay.
There is a bunch of hints, so we're going on the quicker you answer, mm-hmm. the more points you get system.
Okay.
But I think it might be a little hard that alone, so I'm giving you a bonus hint at the end. So the scoring system, I apologize if this is confusing, but it goes like this. You have four clues, mm-hmm. 5 points off the bat,
yep.
4-3-2 mm-hmm. based on the questions. And as yep. a hint at the end, if you still don't have it, I'm going to let you choose one of the relatives we talked about. I'll give you the actor, and then it's worth 1 point.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to let you guess twice.
Okay.
Because I want you to guess out of the gate if you can, but that first clue could be about one or more people, so you may not get it. So I want to give you that free guess. So
okay.
Two guesses during okay. this.
Okay, yep.
So here's your clues.
Mm-hmm.
Father, Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
Mother, Elise.
Mallory Keaton.
Incorrect. Sister one, Mallory.
Oh.
Sister two, Jennifer.
Good old Alex P. Keaton.
Good old Alex P. Keaton. Now, if you needed a clue, I would say any one of those people I mentioned, mm-hmm. I'll tell you the actor. So if you're like, oh, well, who's Steven? That would be Michael Gross.
Sure.
That's how we play the game.
Ugh, gross.
Steel meal situation, please start.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting has one steel meal. I have 5 steel meals plus an extravaganza gong. Value guests have 2 steel meals. So, Heather, this might not be that useful because of the multi-stage
scoring.
But if someone gets down to the nitty-gritty and they are crapped out and you know the answer, you can say steel meal and you can steal the answer, but you know, by then it might only be worth 1 point, I guess.
Yep.
So
got it.
Let's throw it a picky cool. to see who will be going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right, so order today. Heather will start us off, followed by Tara and then Sarah. Are we ready to play Family Ties?
Shalala.
Yes.
Here we go. Heather starting us off.
Okay.
Now remember, we're going to give you 2 cracks at this.
You okay.
2 guesses. The son is Ben. The ex-wife, Carol.
Ross Geller.
And that is worth 4 points. 4 points.
Okay. Got it.
That is correct. Mother Judy, father Jack. Tara.
Yes.
Mother Mona.
Homer Simpson.
That's a 5-pointer. Well done.
Oof.
I do want to say a note on this. I have anything that was half brother or adopted, I struck that. So they're all brothers and sisters or fathers. And so,
fair enough.
Yeah.
So brothers and sisters, the show, probably not in this game because
it's too
complicated.
In the description.
I understand.
They were put in the original game. Herbert there was described as half brother.
I would describe him just as brother. Got it.
Sarah D. Bunting, here comes your first.
Yep.
Mother is Ellen.
Mother is Ellen.
The father, Frank. The sister, Maggie.
Nope.
The daughter, Franny.
The daughter is Franny?
Mother Ellen, father Frank, sister Maggie, daughter Franny.
Carrie Matheson?
Hey! Oh.
That's good for
wow.
2 points. Back to Heather. Son, Frederick. Father, Martin.
Fraser Crane.
4 points. Well done. Tara.
Yep.
Brother, Georgie.
Montgomery Burns? Shit.
Sister, Missy. Mother, Mary. Wife, Amy. Brother, Georgie. Sister, Missy. Mother, Mary. Wife, Amy. Can answer now with your last guess, or are you going to ask for that hint?
Who is Amy?
Amy is Blossom.
Oh, Maya Bialik? Oh, it's Sheldon.
Sheldon.
From
Big Bang Theory. Correct. Sheldon Cooper. Correct for 1 point. 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting. Mother Ruth. Father David. daughter, Rachel. Wife, Elizabeth. Mother, Ruth. Father, David. Daughter, Rachel. Wife, Elizabeth.
Who's Elizabeth?
Alex Kingston.
Wife, Elizabeth. Mark Green?
Yeah.
It's going to be like, here's a hint, you hate
God,
him.
I'm exhausted.
That's good for 1 point. Back to Heather. Sister Georgia. Father Christopher. Grandfather Richard.
Rory Gilmore?
Correct.
Wow.
That is worth three. 3 points. Tara.
Yes.
Sister Paige. Mm-hmm. Son Jack. Brother-in-law, Ben. Wife, Jordan.
Who's Jordan?
Krista Miller.
Oh, it's Dr. Cox from
Dr. Cox from Scrubs. That's good for 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting, back to you. Grandmother, Mary. Mother, Bev. Daughter, Becky.
Roseanne?
That is Connor? Correct for 3 points.
3 points.
Nicely done. Back to Heather.
Okay.
Father, Philip. Brother, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Graham, G-R-A-E-M. Wife, Terry. Daughter, Kim.
Oh, boy.
Father, Philip. Brother, probably Graham. Wife, Terry. Daughter, Kim.
Who played Terry?
Leslie Hope.
Jack Bauer.
Jack Bauer, 24. Good for one.
Boop.
Tara. Beep. Sister, Kate.
Yep.
Father, Roger. Mother, Karen.
Oh, Jake Peralta.
Wife, Amy. Jake Peralta was correct.
Nice.
3 points. It is time for Sarah, and this will take us into our score break. Daughter, Elizabeth. Daughter, Ellie.
Jed Bartlett.
Yeah.
That is good. 4-4. Let's hear those scores, please, Tara.
Very close game. Sarah and I are tied with 10 points each. Heather has 12.
Excellent. Ooh. All right. No Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone today. I thought the game was going to play longer than it is, so I didn't have it ready. I do want to mention now at this point that we're almost halfway through it. There are 30 questions.
Okay.
I forgot to mention that up top. Back to Heather. Daughter, Gracie Bell. Daughter, Julie.
Tammy Taylor.
Son-in-law, Matt.
Coach Taylor.
Eric Taylor.
Dang it. Wrong Taylor.
Wife Tammy was your last full clue. So, Tara.
Yes.
Brother, Charlie. Sister, Trina. Mother, Lynn. Father, Aaron. Brother Charlie, sister Trina, mother Lynn, father Aaron.
Who's Trina?
Trina is Allison Hannigan.
Oh, this is Logan Eccles.
Logan Eccles from Veronica Mars, good for 1 point.
Wow.
Sarah D. Bunting. Mother Veronica. Brother Owen. son, Zach.
Alicia Florrick?
3 points. Mm-hmm. Well done. 2, Heather. Mother,
okay.
Vivian. Father, Philip. Sister, Hillary.
Oh, Carlton Banks.
Carlton Banks, cousin Will, Fresh Prince yeah. of Bel-Air. Good for 3 points. Well done. Tara.
Yes.
Mother, Livia.
Tony Soprano.
Bam.
Nice.
Sorry about that, Sarah. Sometimes picky is good to you. Sometimes she's not.
It happens.
Sarah, here's your question. Son, Henry. Daughter, Paige.
Oh, why can't I remember the last name? Philip?
Philip Jennings, correct, from the Americans. Yes. I was sure if you're going to give me Elizabeth or Philip there. The next clue was, in quotes, wife, Martha. Pretty good.
Poor Martha.
Justice for Martha.
To Heather. Father, Ephraim. Son, Bud. Daughter, Kelly. Husband, Al. Father, Ephraim.
Oh, Peg Bundy.
Peg Bundy, married with children, is, in fact, there we go, correct. And that is good for 2 points. Tara, the aunt, or aunt, is Sophia.
Okay.
The sister is Kimberly. The father is Philip.
So many Philips in this game.
The brother is Willis.
Arnold Drummond.
Arnold Drummond.
From Different Strokes.
Different Strokes is correct, and that is going to get you 2 points. And we move on now to Sarah D. Bunting. Ida is the mother. Ida. Uh-huh. Sister, Susan. Son, Malcolm. Husband, Hal. Mother, Ida. Sister, Susan. Son, Malcolm. Husband, Hal. Probably know the show, but do you know the character?
Probably not. Who plays Hal?
Bryan Cranston.
Mrs. Malcolm, last name Senior? I don't know. I don't know.
Anybody know it?
I can't remember her name.
Lois.
It's just Jane Kazmarek. That's all I know. I don't know.
That's Lois.
Yeah. Lois Wilkerson. Back to Heather now. The father... Jock.
J.R. Ewing.
Guess what, guys?
Wow.
That's our next 5-pointer.
Nice. Yeah.
Gary,
amazing.
Son John Ross.
I drew the right straw on that one. I got lucky.
Tara.
Yes.
Father, Jeremiah.
Okay.
Mother, Aliza.
Okay.
Aunt, Astra.
Uh-huh.
Cousin, Clark.
Is this Kara from Supergirl?
This is Supergirl, correct. 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting, bring us into our second score break. Daughter, Holly. Sister, Marie.
Skylar from
Skylar, good for 4 points. Well done.
Oh, good one. I wouldn't have gotten that.
They're minerals, Marie. And it's time for a score.
Well, less close than it was before. I have 20 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 21 points. Heather has 25 points.
Ooh, all right.
Ooh.
Everybody has... All right. Everybody has 2 questions left. 10 points each maximum.
Okay.
God.
Heather. Uh-huh. Mother, Virginia. Sister, Tandy. Father, Lamar.
Raina James.
Yeah.
Raina James from Nashville is going to get you 3 points.
Nice. Chaps my hide. I didn't get that off of Tandy. I was like honestly. Right there. I couldn't quite get there.
Darn. Brother, Marcus.
Okay.
Father, Marvin. Mother, Judy. Wife, Lily. Brother Marcus, father Marvin, mother Judy, wife Lily.
Oh, this is Marshall from How I Met Your Mother.
That is good for two, correct. Sarah. The mother is Mother Kelp. The husband, Howard. The daughter, Joni. The son, Richie.
What was her name, though? Well, fuck it. Marion Cunningham?
Good for two.
Nice.
The power of fuck it.
Wow.
All right. Everybody has one question left, so let's get a quick update on the scores, please, Tara.
Okay. I have 22. Sarah D. Bunting has 23. Heather has 28.
All right. Well, mathematically, we could force a tie here if somebody's really good and somebody's really bad. Let's find out.
I could seriously wet myself here. Let's see.
All right, Heather. Mother, Ellis.
Meredith Grey?
Yeah!
Yay!
No. You were supposed to be the really bad one. I'm not sure that was clear.
5 points.
Amazing.
Nicely done.
I got lucky.
Oh,
I got
that was
lucky.
Awesome.
What's the father's name? Very distinctive.
It's the guy played by Jeff Perry, and it's it's going to be on the tip of my tongue.
It's British Prime Minister as well.
I know. It's like, I can't, now that you're asking me like on the spot, I can't. Thatcher. Jesus.
Thatcher.
Wowee.
Nicely done. All right, Tara, here's your last.
Yes.
The father is Bill.
Okay. Sure. Of course it is.
The mother, Carol. Very distinctive name so far.
Bill and Carol. Mm-hmm.
The brother, Cal, with a C.
Mm-hmm.
Wife, Alex.
Ugh. Girl, Alex. Who's Alex?
Excuse me, sir. Could you pass the Laura Prepon?
Is this Eric Foreman? No, shit! It's not. It's what's-her-face.
Piper,
yes.
Last question of the game for Sarah D. Bunting. The son is Harrison. The father is Harry. The wife is Rita. The sister... Deborah.
Not that Deborah.
Maybe. I don't know. All right. The son is Harrison. The father is Harry. The wife is Rita. The sister is Deborah.
Who is Harry?
Harry was James Remar.
That doesn't help me at all. I guess this is Benson.
It is not. If you knew that Rita was Julie Benz, would that have helped you?
Oh, yeah, probably. Dexter?
Yes, Dexter. Yeah. That is correct.
Oh, fuck, of course.
I would never have gotten that.
That is regulation, so let's get the final scores, please, Tara.
Wow, this was not close. At the end, I have just finished with 22. Punt. Sarah had 23. Heather destroyed us both with 33 points.
Wow.
Yeah, very lucky.
No, that was amazing. Good job.
That was great. Well
Who
done.
Else should have gotten the Dallas question? I mean, come on.
Picky giveth, picky taketh away. Let's play our tiebreaker for our steel meal for future use.
Okay.
When you feel you might know the answer, yell it out. I'll give you everybody two yells, just like the game.
Okay.
I'll just start reading. Yell when you think you know.
Okay.
Father, Brian. Sister, Jenny. Daughter, Brianna.
Jamie Fraser
from Ooh Leather. Wife, Claire. And that gives you guys not only the victory, but some bonus action for next time.
valued guest.
Well done.
Nice
done.
Game time.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yay!
Guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Grade. We prepared our tech packs and cleared the runway for Amazon's new fashion project, Making the Cut, before discovering why Emily is not a crackpot for suggesting period-appropriate advertising or period shows. We went around the dial with stops at Call the Midwife, One Day at a Time, Barry, Lego Masters, and Top Chef All-Stars. Erica made her successful case for Sherlock's finale's inclusion into the Extra Hot Grade. No knack, phew. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Heather was the winner of this week's Family Ties Game Time.
Shalala.
Next up, we're suggesting relentlessly happy, absolutely stupid, or certifiably zero-calorie shows to shelter in place with on Extra Extra Hot Great. Don't forget about the Quarantine Helper coming Friday as well. And right here on the next EHG Prime, we welcome back Adam Sternberg to review all the wee offerings on Quibi. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
TikTok, TikTok,
Sarah D. Bunting,
this also was not a sewing competition,
and Heather Cox,
I do not make the cut.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grade.
But is it your least favorite?
It's pretty down there.
Ha 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 ha.